Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Let us hear God's word. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in the heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there are also divers vanities. But fear thou God. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by evil travail. He begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. This also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. What profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him. For it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day morning, we return again to the book of Ecclesiastes. I want us to be reminded again of the setting of this book written by King Solomon. Archbishop Usher, in his book, The Annals of the World, says this. He says that in 975 B.C., this took place. Toward the end of his life, Solomon forsook the lusts and vanities to which he was addicted in his latter years. He testified of his deep repentance in his book called The Preacher, Ecclesiastes, and made his peace with God, 2 Chronicles 11:17. Then he goes on, Solomon died when he had reigned 40 years, 1 Kings 11:40 and 12:2. We understand this book to be a book that documents the chronicles of Solomon's life, the chronicles, his search for meaning in all the things of the world and finding that meeting ultimately in God and God alone. We've seen already that his apologetic method is that similar to Proverbs 26, 4 and 5. Turn with me there to Proverbs 26, 4 and 5, just a moment. Here we read in Proverbs, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like him." Then look at verse 5. "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit." In verse 4, we're told to not answer a fool according to his folly. And in verse 5, we're told to answer a fool according to his folly. How can that be? We contend that we're to do both. We're to answer a fool according to his folly, and then routinely, we should then answer him not according to his folly. We really ought to ordinarily do verse 5 first. We ought to explain to a fool the fallacy of his position, how illogical what he holds really is. It's insufficiency to support him in life. And then we should seek to show the biblical pattern. And that's what Solomon is doing in this book. He spends the great majority of his time answering a fool according to his folly, showing that all these pursuits of possessions and pleasures and power, where they lead ultimately. He spends most of his time showing the fallacy, the vanity, the emptiness of all these things. And then he answers a fool not according to his folly. He shows them that they're to fear God, they're to serve God, they're to find their all in all in Him, and that they're to delight in the things that He gives them, and to delight that God not only has given them certain things, but He's also given them the power, the blessing to enjoy thankfully what He has given them with contentment. Now let's look this morning at chapter 5. Here in chapter 5, verses 1 through 8, we have the vanity of irreverent worship. And then in verses 9 through 17, we have the vanity of possessions again, for the third time. And then we have at the end of this section, verses 18 through 20, the remedy. He's already referred to this twice before, at the end of chapter 2 and chapter 3. Now at the end of chapter 5, he again gives a similar remedy to this vanity of possessions. But let us look first at verses 1 through 8 of this chapter. We have, I think, in these verses an admonition to worship in spirit and in truth. He's seeking to show us how to worship reverently in the fear of God, so that our worship is not vain, but that it is substantial, that it is pleasing to God and beneficial to ourselves. I think through those verses we see something about the essence of corporate worship in particular. We see that we're to come to the house of God, and we're to come to His house, and it says in verse 2 that we come before God. You see, God's church is not this building or any other building. It's when God's people meet together to worship Him. But God's church is not a rental property. God doesn't own it and not dwell in it. God's church He owns and He dwells within. It's His house. And so when we come to His house, He's present with us by His Spirit. And so we come before His presence and we come to offer sacrifice. The question is, do we offer the sacrifice of fools or do we offer sacrifice of the wise? That's the question that's before us. And this is the question I believe he's referring to. Now, I won't seek to give any large explanation or thorough explanation of all the various sacrifices, the Levitical sacrifices in the Mosaic system, but I would say that as we look at all those different sacrifices in the Old Testament, I think we could divide them into three primary types. There are three primary things that they're portraying. First is obviously Christ's sacrificial death for His people. Clearly, when the priests laid their hands upon the sheep, and when that sheep was sacrificed, clearly it's a picture of Christ. But also, there are those sacrifices that represent communion. There are those offerings of wine and bread that show communion, the communion that God has with His people and God's people have with Him. Through that once-for-all sacrifice, we have fellowship with God, portrayed uniquely in the Lord's Supper, in the New Covenant administration. But we also see in the sacrifices that there are those, and uniquely the burnt offering was a sacrifice that represented the commitment of God's people to Him. And so we see in these sacrifices, and at least these broad issues, those things still apply to us. When we come to worship, we come through our mediator. We come here to offer worship, sacrifice, new covenant sacrifices because of the once for all finished work of Christ. But we come recognizing that because of that finished work, we can come into communion and fellowship with God. And as we do so, we come and commit ourselves to be His people and to live for His glory. That's the essence of corporate worship. It's the essence of worship. And so we're to present our bodies a living sacrifice as we come to God, Lord's Day by Lord's Day, in His corporate house, worshiping Him corporately. And we're also to present our bodies throughout our days as living sacrifices to Him. In generic worship, always worshiping our God and living before His face. But here in chapter 5, verses 1 through 7a, we have three elements of worship referred to. Just a sample of the elements of worship that applied in the Old Covenant and still apply to us in the New Covenant. Verse 1, He speaks of hearing the Word. Verses 2 and 3, He speaks of prayer. And verses 4 through 7a, He speaks of taking vows. He says in verse 1, "Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil." He says, keep your foot. It's very interesting. What he's referring to is, he's saying, keep yourself from stumbling. You see, walking was the ordinary way people got around. And the roads were pretty rough, and they still are today in Israel. Be careful not to stumble. Quite often this metaphor is used regarding Sabbath sanctification. Don't stumble by not keeping the Sabbath, by not setting apart that day. But then he goes on and he says, be more ready to hear. It could be translated, draw near to hear. In other words, prepare yourself to come and to listen intently. Draw near to hear. Listen up, is what Solomon is saying. He goes on to give a reason, for they consider not that they do evil. Those that come and aren't prepared to hear, they offer the sacrifice of fools. They're going through the motion. Yes, they worship externally, but there's no internal worship. He said that's foolish worship. That's irreverent worship. That's vain worship. He says they don't consider that they do evil. That's similar, isn't it, to that metaphor that James uses in the book of James, James chapter 1, about that man that comes to the Word. He sees himself like a man in the mirror. He leaves. He goes his way. He forgets what he looks like. He saw what he looked like for a moment. It gripped him for a moment. But then so quickly it's taken from him. It's no longer in his consciousness, and it no longer affects him. What he saw of himself as he compares himself with God's Word, his standard, is no longer having any effect in his life. And that's too often the way it is for us when we hear God's Word. Secondly, he speaks of praying in verses 2 and 3. In verse 2a, he says, be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. He says, be thoughtful. Don't be hasty. Order your prayers. David says in Psalm 5:3, I will direct my prayer unto thee. And there, in Psalm 5:3, the word direct is the same word that's used when Abraham orders the sacrifice of Isaac. As he lays those sticks for the offering that he's going to do and light that fire, it says he ordered them, he directed them. We're to order our prayers. We're to think through what we're going to pray before we just begin to rattle off whatever comes to our mind before God. He had an outline. He knew where he was heading, what he wanted, what he believed he was to pray. Job speaks about that he would come before God with arguments. He thought about how he would speak to God, what would be right, and why he ought to ask for certain things. He asked, but he came equipped with arguments, with rationales for why God would to answer his prayers. What are the primary ones? God's glory and our good. Do we want anything that's not for His glory or for our good? I hope not. To be thoughtful. And then he speaks about being brief. For God is in heaven and thou upon earth, therefore let thy word be few. Brevity in prayer is good. We're to pray always, but we're not to give vain repetition, as Jesus speaks about in Matthew 6:7. He goes on to give the rationale, for a dream cometh through the multitude of business. In other words, when you're so busy throughout the day, oftentimes you can't shut down your thinking through the night. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, it's like a fool's voice is known by the multitude of words. If you just keep speaking, it becomes more and more obvious that there's no good treasure in the heart. So order your prayers, be appropriately brief and thoughtful in praying. And this will apply in a greater way to the men of this congregation in weeks to come. If you remember, we're hoping beginning in March on the second Lord's Day morning in the Christian education time to devote ourselves to prayer. And I will be asking some of you to lead us in prayer. Several of us, four or five of us, will lead us in prayer each and every Lord's Day, that once a month. And so we will begin to put in practice what Paul calls us to in 1 Timothy 2, where men raise up holy hands in the assembly of God's people, requesting God for things. And so I think we learn a little bit of how we ought to behave ourselves as we come as the mouthpieces of the people of God to Him. Now, he speaks of vows in verse 4 through 7. He says first in verse 4, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for He hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. He says, if you've taken a lawful vow, pay it, and pay it fast, and pay it cheerfully. Listen to Proverbs 20:25. It is a snare to the man who devoureth that which is holy, and after vows to make inquiry. It says, don't be quick to take a vow and then ask what the vow involves after you've taken it. Too late. Make inquiry first. Know what you're getting yourself into. That's what Solomon's saying. Then he goes on to verse 5. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. He considers not vowing, he considers vowing and not paying. There's also another potential, isn't there? There's a door 3. That's vowing and keeping. That's even better than the other two. But if you're not going to do it, don't vow to do it, is the point. When Solomon compares those two, it's pretty obvious. You're putting yourself under more scrutiny from God when you take a vow and you don't pay the vow. Pay your vows. It's very interesting. In Isaiah 44, 3 through 5, we see that vows are still part of the new covenant. And there in Isaiah 44, 3 through 5, I believe we have a reference to membership vows, to individuals subscribing to be named in Israel, to have Jacob's name upon them. And they subscribe to it. They commit themselves to carry out what God has called them to as members of His kingdom and His family. Then we have in verse 6, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Don't vow something that's sinful. Don't agree to do something that you shouldn't agree to do. When he speaks of causing thy flesh to sin, I think it means causing yourself to sin. Don't cause yourself to sin by promising to do something that you shouldn't do, and then thinking you've got to go do it because you promised to do it. Don't take a vow to do something sinful. Then in verse 6b. Neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? God's going to be angry with you if you commit to something and then you say, well, I was a mistake. I shouldn't have agreed to that. I want out. So be careful to say before the angel. That's singular. So I think it refers either to the minister or messenger, because the word angel can refer to that. But I think here it means even more than that. I think it's referring to Christ Himself, the angel of the covenant. When you come and take vows in God's house, you take vows before God. So don't come before God later and say, I didn't mean it. I was mistaken. Think through, inquire about what your vow, the vow that you're taking, is before you jump into something. And then at the very end of verse 7, we have what I think is the remedy, the soul of worship. The thing that will keep us from vain worship, and that is to have reverent worship, to fear God when we worship. But fear thou God. Listen to Psalm 89:7. God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about Him. Everybody that comes into His presence is to have reverence. No one is excluded. All of us are to come before Him and to fear Him in His assembly, in His congregation, as we meet to worship Him. Yes, we come with joy, but we come with reverence as well. Not one or the other. We come with reverence and we come with joy, but we come with reverence. We're prepared to worship our God. Then we come to verse 8. In verse 8, it's hard to figure out whether it goes in the first section or the next section. If you notice, you have a little paragraph mark there in the King James. Is it a whole other section? This is some of the difficulties of the book of Ecclesiastes. It's not an easy book to outline. It's not an easy book to understand. There are many confusing phrases, and sometimes Solomon seems to jump from one thing to the next very, very abruptly. But it has some reference to the fear of God. He says, if you understand that God is sovereign, that He's in control, then when you see oppression of the poor, when you see perverting of judgment and justice, he's spoken about that before, marvel not at the matter. Don't be surprised. Don't be taken off your focus by seeing such. Remember, he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. In other words, he's saying, there may be a higher magistrate that catches on, that he sees it, and it will be rectified. And if that's not the case, there's somebody even higher, God Himself. Every wrong judgment will be righted at the judgment day. Some of them will be righted here on earth. Some of them will await the judgment seat of Christ. So don't be surprised. Be saddened, but don't be diverted from what you're called to do in serving Christ. Fear God. Then he goes on in verses 9 through 17 to deal again with the vanity of possessions. And here I found some help from Matthew Henry, and if you look at him in this section, you'll see that the general outline is very, very close to him at this point. I could do no better. Changed it a little bit for 21st century ears, but other than that, this is Matthew Henry, at least at the broad outline. We see first in verse 9, the products of the earth are valuable. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. We see the word moreover. There's some connection here in verse 9 to verse 8. There's some transition, though I don't quite see it that strong. There's some loose connection there between verse 8 and 9. What he says here is that there is a great dependence of mankind upon agriculture. We often forget that in our society. Most of us have lived in a period of time in this nation where we've never really experienced a severe famine that's really kept us from eating adequately. Most of us have never experienced a famine of money that's really impacted us and kept us from eating adequately. But the great majority of the world, the great majority of people that have ever lived, they've gone through those times. They've experienced real hardship regarding sustenance for their own bodies. The Geneva Notes say this. They say, kings and princes cannot maintain their estate without tillage. That's agriculture. Which commends the excellency of tillage. I think we have some in our midst who appreciate husbandry, horticulture, or agriculture. It's very important. A king can't survive if nothing grows. If God says, no more growth, eventually it's going to affect the king's estate as well. We're all dependent upon God. And God is pleased to give us through the earth, isn't it? As the earth feeds the animals and we feed upon the earth and the animals, it's all from His hand. Products of the earth are valuable. And you can never have too much money if God stops the flow of food. It doesn't matter how much money you have. That's the point. He goes on in verse 10, the more men have, the more they want. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. This is also empty. Consider this description of that man who is not pleased with what he has. In Habakkuk 2:5 we read of him, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied. He's proud. He can't be satisfied. He keepeth not at home. It doesn't mean he doesn't go out to work somewhere. What it means is, he's always looking to close another deal, to make another buck, to work a little bit more overtime so that he's never home. His work is everything. Everything revolves around the almighty dollar because he's enlarged his desire. He's not happy with what he has. He wants more, 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 more. Have you ever considered that Ahab's crown didn't give him rest until he had Naboth's vineyard? All that he had and Naboth's little vineyard over there, he had to have. He goes whining to his wife. He's not happy. All that he has. But he wants that vineyard. It's how often we are just like that. We're not satisfied with what we have. And if people aren't satisfied with the worldly abundance that they have, how can we ever be satisfied with worldly abundance when we need to satisfy our spiritual desires? Will worldly things ever satisfy that spiritual hunger that we have? The answer is obvious, no. It doesn't satisfy the hunger we have for possessions when we get them, does it? Why should we ever think that possessions would satisfy that deeper spiritual hunger in someone's heart? So we see the products of the earth are valuable. The more men have, the more they want. Then we see in verse 11, the more men have, the more they need. The more occasion they have to spend it. The more lawyers and accountants and everything else they need. In 1 Kings 4:22 through 26, we have a description of the provisions that Solomon used up. All the food that was expended in his house each and every day to support all the people that were under his oversight. As your wealth grows, you need more people to help you take care of it. I think that's the point there. Then we see in verse 12, the more men have, the more they care about it. The more they have, the more concern and worry they have for it. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. It's a wonderful blessing to have a job. It's a blessing. And when we work heartily unto God, the sleep is sweet. In other words, our sleep is absent from careful thought and worrying and covering. And what helps us? The blessing of a job and of doing that job to God's glory. The sleep of a laboring man, it could literally mean the sleep of a servant. The one that has to work. Think of Psalm 127, verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. For so He giveth His beloved sleep. A job is a blessing of God. So is sleep. Sleep without worry, without covetousness, without anxiousness, that is a gift of God. And if you don't have that gift, ask for that gift. If you don't have a job, ask for it. If you don't have that sleep, ask for it. God says He'll give it. We don't muster it up ourselves. We don't emotionally manipulate ourselves to have it. It says it's a gift of God. His beloved, He'll give sleep. It's vain. It's empty. It's useless to rise up early to sit up late. He says, don't burn the candle at both ends. And I thought through that metaphor. I've never gotten that metaphor till this week. What does it mean to not burn the candle at both ends? There's one end of a day, and there's another end of a day. And if you get up before the sun comes up, you've got to light a candle in days of all. You've got to turn the lights on. And if you stay up late, you've got to light the candle again. Don't burn the candle on both ends. Don't spend too much time awake when it's dark in the morning and too much time when it's dark at night. Don't do both. You may get up early, you may stay up late. Don't do both of them. Don't burn the candle. Don't burn the light bulbs at both ends of your day. It's vain. You think you'll get ahead by it eventually. You won't. You won't. One of you have studied under J. Adams, and he, as well as a number of counselors, suggest that oftentimes when someone is in deep depression, the first thing you have to check on them about is their physical state. How are they sleeping? What's their diet? Because we are psychosomatic beings. We are soul and body. And our bodies affect our souls. But we can get good sleep if we ask for it and if we labor diligently while we're awake and don't burn the candle at both ends. Then, in verse 13, he says, the more men have, the more danger they're in. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their own hurt. It's like Solomon says in Proverbs 1:19. He speaks of those whose ways are this. They're greedy for gain, and he says, it takes away the life of the owners thereof. They think they're getting something, and in fact, they're not getting it. They're ambitious. They have a love for money. Remember, we've seen before in 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10, nothing's wrong with money. It's the love of money that's bad. Because if you're ambitious, if you're greedy for it, seeking it, you never get what you think you're going to get. You think there's some blessing there in it, and when you get it, you don't get a blessing, you get a curse. Because you haven't lost the ambition. That greed is still there, eating you up from the inside, tearing you apart. It destroys people. He goes on in verse 14, the more men have, the more they have to lose. The more you have, the more you have to lose. That's related to the worry. When you have so much, it takes more time and effort to think about it, doesn't it? To protect it. But those riches perish by evil travail. He begetteth the son, and there is nothing in his hand. He can lose it very, very quickly. He had a lot. He worked very difficultly or hardly. And I think that's what evil travail is referring to. He worked with much affliction. But then a calamity comes on. He gets a son, and there's nothing in his hand. By the end of the life, all that he accumulated, he doesn't have anything to give for the son he begat. He worked very hard, accumulated, gone. The more men have, the more they can lose. Think of that rhetorical question, Proverbs 23:5. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? Can you look at something that doesn't exist? For riches certainly make themselves wings and fly away as an eagle toward heaven. You think there's something there, there's nothing there. It's gone. As quick as it came, it can be gone. The more you have, the more you lose. Then we have in verse 15 and 16, the more men have, the more they must leave. The more they must leave. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. We can't take it with us. And this is also a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. That refers to die. This is he came when he was born, so when he goes and he dies, he can't take it with them. Remember the words of Paul, 1 Timothy 6:7. We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. It's certain. It's not probable. It's absolutely sure. We will never take anything with us. Nobody ever has, and nobody ever will. Then why do we all act like we will? When we know, intellectually, nobody ever has, nobody ever will, but we spend most of our days thinking we're going to take something with us. Listen to the Puritan Edward Reynolds. That which hath no power to free us from death, to comfort us in death, to go with us into another world after death, is a foundation of happiness or solid tranquility. You see, if it can't free us from death, if it can't comfort us in death, if we can't take it after death, why do we act as though it's a foundation, though it's so important to us for our happiness? It brings no happiness. He goes on in verse 17. Those that set their hearts on their possessions live sad lives. All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. He eats in darkness. I'm not sure if it's because he's so miserly that he doesn't want to light a candle and use it up. That could be. But I think there's something more there than that. It's not that he's worried about the candle or that we may be worried about the electricity. But I think there's something more there. I think he's saying he eats in darkness. He eats worrying and fearing about all that he has. He's so wound up in all that he has, he eats in darkness. He doesn't even enjoy what he's eating. He's already thinking about everything that he has and everything he still wants. Then he goes on to say, and he hath much sorrow and wrath in his sickness. He gets sick, and he's worried and upset because he can't get back out there and make more money. He can't even enjoy a good meal. And when he gets sick in God's providence, he can't enjoy the couple days of retrieve on his bed, trusting God. He's vexed. He's not getting. Think of Proverbs 13:25. The righteous eateth to the satisfying of his soul, but the belly of the wicked shall want. The righteous eateth to the satisfying of the soul. Whatever he has, it's pleasing because he knows it's God's. God's given that to him. The belly of the wicked, whether he doesn't have enough because of his laziness or he has so much because of his greed, it doesn't satisfy. He still lacks. Then we have the remedy again for the third time in verses 18 through 20. This is the remedy that Solomon's gone back, comes back to for the third time. He's spoken about at the end of chapter 2, the end of chapter 3. He says, use well what you have to serve God with it, to do good with it, and to take comfort in it for yourselves and for your families. Enjoy what God has given you. God not only gives it to you, he says, but he's given you the power to enjoy it. You see, to those that He doesn't love, to those that are foolish, sometimes He gives them great abundance, but He doesn't give them the power to find any pleasure or satisfaction with it. And we need to thank God that God's given us what we have. It's His gift. And He's also given us a level of contentment with it. And we need to confess that level of discontentment that we have. That's what we're called to do. God gives us wealth, we see in Deuteronomy 8:18. In 1 Timothy 6:17, we see that we're to use that, what we have, with cheerfulness. We learn in Ephesians 4:28 that we should moderate our joy with labor. We're not to be like those English gentlemen of the Victorian period and to glory that we don't work. We're to work. It's a blessing. And also in 2 Thessalonians 3:12, we see that we're not to burden others. We're to seek as we can, as we're fit and as we're able, as God provides, to not be a burden to others, but to provide for ourselves and those we love. Then we see in verse 20, "For He shall not much remember the days of His life." He's not saying that if we do this, if we appreciate and enjoy the things God's given us, we'll be forgetful. No, what He's saying is that we'll cheerfully enjoy the fruit of our labor and we won't be those that dwell upon our sorrows. We'll acknowledge them, we won't deny them, we won't be stoical and pretend like everything is always wonderful, but when we find contentment with what God has given us, our focus is not the sorrows that God brings our way. They're there, we remember, but it's not much upon us. Our thoughts are predominantly thankful for those crosses, for those afflictions, and for the good things that God has given us. Good things materially and ultimately, good things spiritually in Christ. Then he goes on to say, "Because God answereth him in the joy of his heart." In other words, God gives him joy. God gives him full compensation for his labor. God gives us full compensation. He's not stingy or niggardly with His people. He gives us abundantly, above and beyond all that we could ask. He gives us that joy. He answers us. He compensates us as His people. What a blessing. Let us learn to appreciate all that God's given us, to enjoy it, to give thanks for it, because it's the gift of God.